Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming out, sharing in the Dhamma. Today I'd like to talk about meditation. It's a good topic. Important topic. It's important to focus on the essentials, to not get so caught up in the details and stories and histories. And to not get so caught up in the superficialities of Buddhism. The superficialities of culture. There's nothing wrong with superficial things, they're just not the core. The Buddha said, I'm going to get this wrong, sare asare saradassino, sare cha saramattino, te sare nati kacchanti. Micha gochara sankappa, which means sara. Sara is the essence. Seeing what is not the essence and what is the essence, and seeing the essence as non-essential. Such a one doesn't come to the essence, doesn't get to the core, because their mind wanders in improper pastures. Sare cha sarato nyatva asare cha sarato. I forget it. Can't remember the second verse. Anyway, not important. Tonight we're going to talk about something essential: meditation. Meditation is interesting. It's a terrible word. It's a terrible word because it doesn't mean anything. There's nothing wrong with the word. I'm just lamenting the fact that we seem to think of meditation as a single thing. Most of you don't. Most of us don't. Those of us who have been initiated, I think, are beyond that. But another problem with the word meditation, besides just the fact that it could mean anything, another problem is in the sense that meditation should be comfortable and it should be natural. I had a good question on yesterday when I was talking in this Indian religions class. Someone asked, do you think active or passive meditation is better? Passive meditation, where you just let your mind wander, or not wander, he said, let your mind observe or go where it will. And active meditation, where you actively try to direct the mind. And that's well put, I think, because many people have the idea that meditation should just be letting your mind wander. And they wouldn't probably use the word wander, but there should be a sense of calm, and it should feel comfortable, natural. But that's not what meditation is. Meditation actually is something artificial. Meditation is a tool. I think the tool analogy is really useful. Tools can be used for two main purposes, let's say. Tools can be used to build things, fix things, and tools can be used to destroy things, break things. I think those are the two main, well, they're two main uses of tools anyway. But the tools are not the object, you see. Why tool is such a good analogy? It's because the thing that you're building or breaking is distinct from the tool. You don't, when you end up, when you finish building whatever it is that you built, you don't look at it and see the tool. You don't see anything of the tool in the thing that you built. If you carve a statue, you don't see the chisel. Similarly, if you break something up into dust, you aren't able to look at it and say, oh look, there's the sledgehammer. So meditation is not, it isn't meant to be like the goal. It isn't meant to be like the, even the progress on the path. This is why we separate vipassana and satipatthana. Vipassana is the goal. Sort of. Vipassana is the catalyst. It's the energy or the impetus, the thing that pushes you on to enlightenment, propels you. It's the propellant. But it comes from something quite different, sati. Mindfulness. So there's two aspects. There's the practice and then there's the results. And the practice is completely artificial. That's what tools are. They're things you create, you build, in order to perform a function on something else. Now this is the thing, the something else is interesting. And Buddhism, even in the Abhidhamma, it even talks about this. There are the object and, well, the Abhidhamma says something interesting in this regard. It talks about the object and the name. The object and the label. It's interesting because we use labels, right? And so I remember when I was in Los Angeles, there was this Thai monk who was becoming quite famous and was outright critical of the Mahasisayata tradition in, as practiced in Thailand. He said, if you note, the noting is a concept, right? If you have this mantra, well, mantras are concepts, he said. And he said, if you use a concept, that's samatha, that's not vipassana. And it was interesting, I heard this. And I had had students of his come and see me just so they could refute what I was teaching. Yeah, that happens. And they said, it's a concept. And I said, look, I know where you're getting this from. This guy is wrong. I can't remember. I may have had to wrestle with it a while for me, myself, to figure it out. I think it was, I was listening to Usilananda talk about the Abhidhamma. Talk about the Visuddhimagga, actually, I think. And I think it was the Abhidhamma, and I just happened to hear him say this. There are two kinds of concepts. Names are concepts, and objects are concepts, and nama panyati and aramana panyati. Usilananda is a deceased disciple of Mahasisayana, fairly famous. He was in California, actually. I never got to meet him, but that's where he lived for a long time. And when I heard this, I thought, that's it. That's the explanation. Because objects can be both conceptual and they can be real. For example, a person, when you send love to beings, may this person be happy, may they be free from suffering, the object is a concept, because the person isn't real, the person isn't ultimate reality. Ultimate reality being seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, thinking. And then, of course, so then you can have an ultimate reality as your object. Seeing is an ultimate reality. Pain is an ultimate reality, that kind of thing. But the name of the thing is always going to be a concept. Right? The name pain is just a concept. And the name Fred or person is just a concept. And so absolutely, meditation is this artificial construct. And that's what mantra meditation is. When you say walking, walking. The word walking is a concept, but the experience of walking is real. And so that's interesting, to show the difference between objects and the tools that we use to approach the objects. Vipassana meditation has nothing to do with whether you use a word or don't use a word, whether you note or don't note, mantra, no mantra. Vipassana meditation has to do with the object. Is the object real? Is it part of the body? Is it part of the mind? It's something that arises and ceases. If so, then it's vipassana. And so this is the first important thing to be clear that I wanted to make clear tonight, is that meditation is meant to be artificial. You don't have to worry about that and feel like, wow, this doesn't feel natural. The problem with natural, you see, is, well, that's who we already are. If you want to change something, if you want to pull the Buddha used the imagery of an elephant stuck in the mud. How do you get an elephant that's stuck deep in the tar sands? How do you get it out? You're just going to pull on it? Probably need some heavy equipment. A rope at the very least, right? Something artificial, some sort of tool. You're going to build a house? Well, you don't build it with your bare hands. You're going to tear down a house? Well, have you ever done demolition? Tools. Tools are where it's at. Now, so that's the first question. The second question is, which are we doing? Are we building or are we tearing down? So the first question is about the tools. Our tools are artificial. They should be natural tools, using your bare hands and trying to tear down or build up, not really feasible. So anyone who tries to sit down and just says, well, I'm just going to sit and meditate. If they don't have a plan, if you don't have tools, right? And the best tool, I think, is a mantra. I'm really adopting this terminology. I think I'm the only Mahasi Sayadaw teacher who's ever adopted this terminology of a mantra. I've never heard it used. I really think we should. It helps make it familiar. It helps us understand what we're talking about. It helps contextualize it, because it is contextual. There's a context and a history, a long tradition of using mantras. that predates the Buddha, and it's where it was taken from by the Buddha, by his disciples, by modern day disciples following the tradition. So that's the first part, is the artificial tools. Second part is, what are we doing? Are we building up or are we tearing down? And the third question is, that which we're the result, is the result artificial or is the result natural? Right? So we've talked about tools being artificial. I think that's necessary. Necessary to understand that if you want it, if a tree is leaning in the wrong direction, you want to lean it in the other direction, you need some serious tools. So you have this tree, it's going to fall in the wrong direction. The Buddha used this imagery as well. You need a rope and you need to pull real hard. Get it in the other direction. You got a cow, a baby cow, and you want to train this baby ox, let's say. This ox they use to pull things. You want to train it. You have to take it away from its mother and you have to tie it to a post and make sure the rope is tight. Because you can't just let it wander. You know what it'll do? It'll just stick with its mother and it'll grow up to be a spoiled ox. I think most Buddhists don't like that. I'm not particularly fond of this imagery, but it's in the Visuddhimagga. So I'm thinking, well, the poor little ox, why don't you just leave it alone, right? But you see, we're not talking about oxen, we're talking about the mind. And the mind isn't something we want to leave alone. Why? Well, because we have a sense that this meaningless round of samsara is it's substandard. It's inideal, not ideal. It's less than ideal. It's full of stress, and the situation that we can see ourselves in today as human beings is subpar. We can do better than this. And so we want to better ourselves. So we're trying to get our minds in the other direction. But here's the question, is that result supposed to be natural or artificial? And it's a good question. It's an important question. And it relates to the other question of whether we're building up or tearing down. Because the problem is that anything you build up, anything that you use tools to build up, is artificial. I mean, it's an interesting distinction that the earth builds mountains, right? We don't say they are artificial, but they're built up by forces, not human forces, but they're built up. Seeds grow into trees. Hey, ants grow anthills. Are those artificial? So artificial and natural is fairly interesting. I gave a talk on this once. I got in real trouble. I'd started saying, yeah, the body's artificial. The body's not natural. I don't remember how I got into it, but people were saying, is sex natural? I think it was probably where it started, is sex natural? I said, no, sex is not natural. It's unnatural. Sex is an unnatural thing. Didn't go over very well. The body is an unnatural thing. So I gave a video explaining it. And it was basically that the fact that we have these words natural and unnatural means something. And they're just words. Truth of the matter is everything is natural. You know, the words are meaningless if you think of ultimate reality, because in ultimate reality it's all natural. But but our meaning, and it's an important meaning, is that which we have created, that which sentient intelligence has created. We've created the body. So it's a distinction that we give, that the body has been created. And it's a Buddhist belief, I guess you could say, because most of us aren't conscious of this fact. We don't realize, and we aren't able to empirically investigate this fact. The body seems natural. It comes from mother and father, but it doesn't really. It's very much formed by our acts. It's formed by our karma. Ours and our parents, so we kind of do it together. But anyway, the question is whether, right, so the question is whether artificial or natural, built up or tear down. And why I talk about this and think it's important is that I think meditators often try to build something up. I don't think that's how we should look at meditation. I think we should be careful to realize when we're just building up what could be termed as a sankhara. I know in the Goenka tradition they use this word a lot, sankhara, and they use it fairly well, but you have to be careful. Sankhara, any artificial, any habit, you know, a habit is a sankhara. When you build up a habit, or when you suppose you force yourself to be neutral, you cultivate equanimity. It's an artificial state. It means it takes effort to build. It's called sankhara dukkha. It's dukkha. It's unsatisfying because of the effort that it takes to build it. The effort that it takes to create and manifest it. And we see this in the Buddha's teaching. We see this sort of disinclination to build. You look at the Buddha's talking about the seven bojangas. The bojangas are a really good example of this, because bojangas are what the Buddha said about that we should cultivate. The seven bojangas are called bhavana. When the Buddha used the word bhavana, he most often was referring to the seven bojangas. Bojangas. The seven factors of enlightenment. Said bhavana bhattaba. If you want to destroy your defilements or abandon your defilements, cultivate these seven things. And so we have sati. Sati, of course, is the first one. That's what we have to cultivate. And dhamma vicaya means we have to be able to distinguish the dhammas, discriminate. It means being able to see rupa and nama, being able to see kusala, akusala, good, bad. Basically means being able to see things as they are. So through sati you start to see reality from an experiential point of view. Dhamma vicaya. And then effort, virya. You work to, you put out effort to change your mind, get rid of the evil, cultivate the good. Guard against the evil, maintain the good. And then piti is like routine. Piti is like habit. Piti refers to anything that becomes ingrained. So lots of kinds of piti. But in this context it means you become caught up in, becomes habitual, it gains a power to it. So you practice mindfulness again and again, and you cultivate these other dhamma, these other bojangas, and there a power comes from it. The energy becomes strong, and you become set in it, unshakable. after piti, then there's pasadi. Pasadi. Pasadi means tranquility. Your mind calms down. You have to cultivate tranquility, right? After tranquility comes samadhi, concentration. You have to focus. Keep the mind on the object. Keep the mind in the present moment. And finally, upekha. Upekha means equanimity. You have to cultivate this. Right? These are the seven things to be cultivated. But then the Buddha says, or points out, that you can't just go about cultivating these seven willy-nilly. You can't just decide, today I'm going to cultivate this one, or I'm going to work on that one, or this one needs to be tweaked. And this goes back to the artificial natural debate, because if you cultivate one, it's an artifice, it's artificial, it's not natural, a natural outpouring of who you are. So anytime in meditation that you start pushing harder, or you start focusing, forcing your mind to stay focused, or you push yourself to be equanimous, this is like opening up the hood of a car and poking and prodding the various pieces and trying to get it to move. You know, or you have a bicycle, maybe it's easy to think of a bicycle, and you start pushing on the front wheel to make it move instead of pedaling on the pedals. Thing is, when you pedal the pedals, all the other parts of the bike start working. Someone gives you a push on a bike, well, you might go a little ways, but it's not sustainable. And so the Buddha said these bojangas, they depend on an imbalance. The only time they should be increased, the only time they should be cultivated, is when you're imbalanced. If you're too much on the distracted side, your mind is not able to focus, you're anxious, restless, stressed, too much energy, then you should focus on the latter ones, pasadi, samadhi, and upekha, tranquility, concentration, and equanimity. But when your mind is tired, is drowsy, lazy, inert, then you should focus on the other three, the Dhamma Vicaya, Viriya, Piti. Discrimination, effort, and rapture. But the seventh one, the first one, Sati, the Buddha, this is where the Buddha said, Satin chokohang bhikkhave sabbatikang vadami. But mindfulness, O monks, mindfulness, I tell you, mindfulness is useful everywhere, at all times. I think that's significant, and what it tells us, what it leads us to understand, is that mindfulness is the key. Ajahn Tong used to say, if you want to run a car, you just turn the key. You don't have to go around turning on all the parts of the car. You turn the key and the whole engine starts. All the parts start by themselves. And in meditation, this is really how you succeed. You don't go about trying to adjust all the other parts, all the other qualities of mind. You use mindfulness and you perceive the imbalance and use mindfulness to correct it naturally. So mindfulness is about tearing down. It's not about building up. And you just keep tearing down and tearing down. And what evolves from it is something quite natural. There's a natural wisdom, natural effort, natural exuberance, natural tranquility, natural focus, natural equanimity. These come natural, like when you smash up a concrete parking lot, the weeds start to poke through, the trees start to grow, and eventually you get a forest. This is how it should appear, this is how it should feel to the meditator. So much of what we come into the meditation with is just imbalances. Falling asleep in meditation, it's an imbalance. You don't have to correct it, you just have to be mindful so that the natural state can come out. You just keep reminding yourself. Another way to look at it is untying knots. If you don't like the breaking analogy, the untying. Anto jata bahi jata, jataya jatita pacha. Tang tang go tamak pujami ko imang wijataye jatang. Everyone's all tangled up. This angel asked the Buddha, who can untangle the tangle? The inner tangle, the outer tangle. And the Buddha said, Sile patitaya naro sapanyo, sapanyu, panyo. Chitang panyancha bhavayang atapi nipako bhikkhu so imang vichataye chatang. So basically sila samadhi panya. Sila samadhi panya is the Eightfold Noble Path. It's morality, concentration, wisdom. And again, it's mindfulness that leads you through the Eightfold Noble Path. It's mindfulness, the four satipatthana. The four satipatthana help you cultivate morality. They help you focus. And they help you focus in such a way that wisdom arises, insight arises. And this unties the knots. This is what it will feel like. You don't have to think theoretically about like the Eightfold Noble Path. Practically, when you feel pain and you say pain, pain, if you get good at it, you untie the knot, the disliking of the pain. When you're worried, you say worried, worried. When you want something or you like something, if you're addicted to something, you untangle it. You start to see this is the pleasure, this is the wanting, the liking. This is the experience of seeing or hearing or smelling or tasting or feeling or thinking. And you untangle it all and you see it for what it is and you see that it's meaningless, it's useless, it's unsatisfying, it's unbeneficial, does you no good. That's what meditation's all about. Untying the knots, breaking down the artificial constructs of who we are, identity. There's another way to understand this is meditators often break down literally. They feel like they're failing. I remember crawling into my teacher one morning and crying. And he said, what's wrong? What's wrong? And I said, Ajahn, I can't do this. My why? You break down, you fail. Failure is good. It's good for the soul. It's good for your humility. It's good for the ego. Good to destroy the ego. If you're failing, then it's a sign that you're trying, which is a problem. It's a sign that you still have ambition. If you're practicing and it just isn't working, If it isn't working, then stop trying. It's kind of a riddle, I suppose. Maybe it's a Zen koan. I don't want to be riddle or vague or so on. You have to practice. You have to be mindful. But the quality of mindfulness is about untying and tearing down. It feels like deconstructing. You're not building up some state. Oh, I can watch my feet from one end of the room to the other. Oh, I can watch my stomach throughout the whole practice. All you've done is construct something. It's going to fall apart. Meditation is like war. I've never been to war, but it's what I assume war to be like. Messy. Improvisational. You don't get to make the rules in war. You just fight for your life. And you find the solution that works in the present moment. You improvise. You adapt. And you tear down. Alright, so that's our Dhamma for tonight. Some thoughts on the word meditation and the nature of meditation and how it's analogous to a tool. What's my take on this dark night of the soul stuff? Yeah, past karma. I want to be clear. Anyone who says dark night, that a dark night of the soul is part of the path, is using terminology that the Buddha didn't use, that is not used in the commentaries, and I think is confusing defilements with insight. You don't have to go through a dark night, and moreover, calling something, that's the first problem. So there's two distinct problems. The second problem is that it doesn't actually exist. And as soon as you start this idea of this dark night, and again, I'm not totally familiar, but I do have a fairly, you know, I've been instructed on basically what it means, so I do have an understanding of it. It's no different to say I'm going through a dark night than it is to say that I have a problem with depression or anxiety or any other mental illness. These things do not exist. You start stringing experiences together and calling them something. You've made your problems atomic. Remember how I talk about this word? Atoms aren't helpful. You can't split an atom. You can't. It's impossible to split an atom. This is the irony that they split an atom. It's because it wasn't atomic. Atomic is something that can't be split by very definition of the word. As I understand. Anyway, you say a dark night. Now you've got this thing that you have to deal with. How do you deal with a dark night, right? Well, I guess you go through it. But the problem is you've identified, you've created an entity. You can't see impermanent suffering and non-self. You can't see the nature of reality. Reality is moments. And so if you're depressed, you're depressed in a moment. You know, it's not actually depression. It's disliking or it's thinking or it's deconstruction. So this is something that should be discarded. Don't rely on such terminology. It's not part of the path, it's not a description of the path, and it's not a reality. The reality is the individual experiences that arise and cease. Many of them are troubling, many of them are stressful, many of them are depressing, you know. Well, none of them are actually, but they evoke this in us because we have bad habits of reacting to things negatively. So that's my take on that, and that's all I have to say about that. Can we say that the tilakana three characteristics are natural in the pala fruit coming to pass when the hetu causes are present is also natural. Yeah, yeah. I mean, seeing the three characteristics are real. I mean, they're what things are, but seeing them is an untying of the knots. I mean, the knot is seeing things as stable, satisfying, and controllable. When you see them that they're not that, that's what unties the knots. That's the untying of the knots. That's the tearing down of the constructs and the habits. I don't understand the pala fruit coming to pass when the causes are present. You're talking about, oh, hetu pala, yeah, we use those words. Sorry. Evening's probably the worst time to be broadcasting because I only eat in the morning and people don't bring me juice anymore, so the energy starts to wane. Yeah, I know, hate pon. In Thai they say hate pon, hate to pala. So, yeah. You're talking about cause and effect. So cause and effect is, you know, that's not what I meant by that's all natural in a sense, but it's not what I was referring to. I was thinking of the outcome. Have we constructed something? In the end, have we constructed something? Or have we torn it down? And so the distinction there is that anything you construct is in that sense artificial. So it has to be more like breaking down things. You're thinking of another definition of the word nature in terms of the natural order kind of thing. Glad to be of help. It's always nice to share something useful. Is the mind a tool as well? Oh, I think you guys are overthinking this. Don't get too off track. No, the only tool is the meditation. Don't think of the mind as a tool. It is, you can say, yes, it's a tool by which we meditate, but no, you're getting too complicated. This is just the simple thing about meditation. Meditation is a tool we use. Yeah, see, now you're philosophizing, you're sophizing. Don't go there. It's not that complicated. Jayata bhikkhave, meditate, O monks. All right, well then, if there are no other questions, have a good night, everyone. Oh. All right, one more question. Yeah, reading a book of Mahasi Sayadaw said something like not to note rising and falling as words. Yeah, that's one thing that's good about this book, The Manual of Insight, is because the only place that I know of where it actually says that is in an English translation of the fifth chapter of The Manual of Insight. And here we have this new translation that omits that sentence, properly omits that sentence. I've looked at the Thai translation. I was concerned about this sentence because it would mean something, but there's another passage that was sent to me, and I don't think I have it. I don't know where it is. Maybe it's in my email. That was perfectly elucidating in this, in regards to this this passage, or this, no, this this question, I suppose, this issue, where the Mahasi Sayadaw says, if you don't want to note, you don't have to note, and that's fine, but it's not as it's not as clear. He said, we ask you to note because we want clarity, and we want to be sure that you're practicing properly. We want to have this distinct certainty, I suppose, that you're actually aware of things as they are. If you don't use the mantra, if you don't use the words, then yes, you might very well be mindful, but you might very well not be mindful. How could you judge whether at this point you're mindful or at that point you're mindful? The mantra is a tool. It's this artificial tool that we use to cultivate mindfulness, to keep the mind grasping the object properly without judgment or bias or identification and so on. So you'd have to give me a specific citation, but I'm pretty sure I've for myself anyway debunked the passage that says that. I've also been told by several people that Upandita teaches the meditators, or taught, is he still alive? Taught his meditators to give up the words, but yeah, I don't know, give up the mantra idea after a while or something. I don't subscribe to that, that's all I can say about that. Okay, good night. Be well, everyone.